Between the arches, suspended on thick knotted slings, or depending directly from the inner curves of the arches, enormous sacks like deflated balloons hung, their lower extremities bulging round with deposits of dark fluid. To left and right, translucent blisters interrupted the resilient floor, each 3 to 4 meters broad and rising above the level of our waists. Within the blisters, coiled tubes and flattened oblongs pressed together against the membrane, pale in themselves, but surrounded by a dark, thick fluid like petroleum. A dozen steps ahead, the arches met at an inner chamber, its walls curved inward like the cubic intersection between 6 enormous bubbles. All the surfaces within the hemisphere were sections of large bubbles, expertly fashioned and cut or intersected by other bubble surfaces of varying diameters. We might have entered the interior of a vast radiolarian, one of the silicate-skeletoned microscopic sea creatures of Earth's oceans. We walked slowly between these mingled wonders. A new odor filled the air, sweet as perfume, musky. "The outer veil! Smell it," Brian said, waving his hand. "There are 8 veils, 8 airborne layers of scent. I carried a small scion here once 6 months ago. It struggled in my arms, and when it passed through the 3rd scented veil, it collapsed in a thick liquid and fell through my fingers. What lies within tolerates none of its children, unless they have permission. And the only scions who have permission are the spies, the samplers and gatherers that bring information. What lies within is always hungry for patterns, blueprints, diagrams, information." Halfway across the interior, we saw a storage area for slabs and chunks of rock, slates, sandstones, conglomerates, flints, and other varieties, arranged in piles with little apparent sense of order, covering perhaps 100 square meters in the overhang of a main supporting arch. The piles rose over our heads in the center, and just to one side, an elephant-sized, many-clawed scion stood unmoving, except for a slight trembling of its forward limbs. Many spiked, gripping claws as long as my legs, some with sharp, chisel-shaped tips. At its base lay split sections of stone, revealing beautiful, impressed fossils. Brian stepped between 2 stacks and pulled out a shallow slab of limestone about 30 centimeters on a side. "She had these rocks collected and brought here. She uses them as a kind of library." He held the 20-kilogram slab out to us. Embedded in the limestone was a black outline, a many-legged arthropod surrounded by broad, feather-shaped feelers. "When my wife and I first came here, she couldn't see. She stored these fossils and studied them without eyes, tasting and feeling them." Salep stood beside Brian, hands held out, fingers greedily spread. He took the fossil, eyes nearly starting from their sockets. "Was this a scion?" he asked. "I don't know," Brian said. "It's at least tens of millions years old. If it's older, it comes from the era of shelly creatures that covered so much of Lamarckia with thick layers of limestone and made it so difficult to find metals and other minerals. How old do you think the Ikoi are?" "I've guessed hundreds of millions of years," Salep said. Brian shook his head. "Shea was the first, and it may be less than 20 million years old. As for the rest, at most they're only a few million years old. Life was small and very simple before Shea. When Shea ventured out on land, there was very little oxygen and no ozone in the upper atmosphere. It covered itself with a thick protective layer. It may have taken 15 million years for oxygen to reach its present levels." From ahead came a sharp, sweet smell. As we advanced to the inner cube, we passed through several varieties of this same smell, like veils of scent surrounding the body of a revered saint. Brian stopped. The shriveled husks of what appeared to be human bodies lay crumpled at the spreading foot of an arch. The arch rose at least 60 meters to the vague red suffused heights of the dome. The bodies ranged in size from less than 1 meter to over 2 meters, desiccated tissues stretched over internal frames that only crudely resembled skeletons. Blank, hard-tissued faces stared at us with glazed eyes. The heads of dolls manufactured by a toy maker who had failed and cast the inanimate results aside. "These were experiments," Brian said in a low voice. She showed some to us the first time we came here. She knew what she wanted, something to communicate with us. She knew we weren't part of any ECOS, and she desperately needed to discover what we were. The best way for her to learn, her way of learning, was to imitate us. The cubic frame ahead was larger and farther away than I at first thought. It lay 50 or 60 meters beyond the graveyard of rejected human shapes. The last of the distinctive scents wafted around us, this one at once primally offensive and startlingly attractive. Baking bread, hot tar, methane and hexane, smelling salts, and much more. Brian approached the frame at the center of the hemisphere, walking like a tired old man. I tried to imagine his emotional state and could not. What he expected, what it was possible he might see, would have driven many men mad. As he walked ahead of us, he gave a broken explanation in slow fragments of his last visit. He had brought his dying wife inside the blood bubble hemisphere, stayed with her, listening to her last breaths, her last words. "She was in pain," he said, voice shaky and hoarse. He wiped his face with the back of his hand, the string still wound around his finger. "Nobody could save her." He touched the membranous wall of the frame and looked back at me. "She was extraordinary. We both prayed for the Hexamon to come and bring the medicine of Thistledown that Link left behind. He finally had his revenge on us. A lot of my people died the way she did. She lasted longer than most. Her liver and kidneys were rotting away. Such a simple disease to cure on Thistledown. But you did not come. When she died, she died." He pulled his hand back. "It was a relief. I felt as if I had died with her, and that was a relief too. I placed her on the floor inside. I left and camped for 5 days on the edge of the lava field. Sir Frick brought me food from the launch. Nothing happened. Nobody came out of the dome. I couldn't go back inside. We all returned to Naderville." Frick stared at the deepening shadows on all sides with a fearful squint. Hisha Chung stayed close to Brian. Looking at me, she had only hate in her eyes. I represented all lost hope, final disappointment. I was a failure to all of them. No rescue imminent, no change and explanation, no re-embracing in the arms of secure and all-knowing parents. "She's in there," Brian said huskily. "I mean, she's all around, but the heart of her heart is in there. Heart of Shia's life." Outside the hemisphere, clouds must have covered the sun, for shadow enveloped us. All around, faint gleams pricked against the deep red and brown gloom like stars in the heavens. Violet luminosity flickered within the frame. A low sound grumbled beneath our feet. Meters away, beyond several ranks of translucent walls and braces, something swelled like the throat on an enormous bullfrog, then subsided, expelling a sweetly repulsive scent of tar and burning resin. Brian leaned against the wall of the frame, a pale shape against the darker membrane. This time there was no preference for Hisha. The wall seemed to absorb him, and the tissue beneath our feet grumbled again. We heard a remarkable voice, and Salop jumped as if poked in the ribs, high, sweet, like the chirrup of a large insect mixed with a whistling flute. Childlike, yet mannered and mature, it came from within the frame.
"Names clear now," it said. "Names all are and clear."
24. Time has become very unclear. My recovery is going smoothly, the attendants tell me. I am a celebrity in the Hexamon. Janosch floats beside my couch. "Was it Brian's wife?" Janosch asks me. We are in the way, in free fall, in the hospital unit of the Axis City. I do not know for certain if I am dreaming or even dead. I remember telling my story to Janosch and perhaps to others, but it has taken some time, some indefinite time, to reach this point. Events are jumbled. Janosch has changed. He has assumed an older face to give the appearance of many decisions made, of political maturity. Only a few years have passed here, perhaps 10. What does that mean?
Was it Brian's wife?
He asks again patiently. He is first assistant to the newly elected Geshel presiding minister, but has been spending much time in my unit talking to me, awaiting the return of all my memories. I know I am an old man, 90 or 91 Lamarckian years. I must be dead or dying, and this is all a shrinking fragment of imagination. She was dead, I managed to say. What spoke to you, then? His curiosity offends me, as if his wishing to know what the seed mother or the queen looked like betrays a childish and trivial frame of mind. So much else of more importance. What Lenk did or allowed his people to do. The greening, a wave of change, a fluxing across the generations. Shia's use of Brian's gift, his name. All seems compressed to me, and I have to regather my thoughts and find the thread again. Flight added to pain and starvation. The migrations from wherever the greening struck, wherever Shia dominated. And how the name of Brian's wife was given to this tide they had begun, this transformed ecos, now called Caitla. A vast, vibrant specter that had so much to do with that voice, and nothing to do with Caitla herself, for she was dead. Her body lay untouched where Brian had placed it, within the frame, in the depths of the Seed Mother's arena, the huge foam bubble, the color of blood. Nobody behind the voice, I say. You mean no intelligence? No me, no you, no her. I remember pain in my legs, in my arms, all my joints burning, having burned for years. That pain is gone now. I move my fingers and their joints bend with a purity, a smoothness I have forgotten. I do have work to do, Almi, Janosch says. I can't stay here forever. I did order the massive effort to open the geometry stacks. I won't take credit for proposing you be given a second incarnation. You earned that, and the Nexus approved it, and it will not even count against your allowed rebirths. I am not grateful. I understand the value of death. My body, the body I no longer have, prepared my soul by decaying across a full and natural span of life. Because of so many years of starvation and flight, of grief and trial, my body became tough and refused to die easily. But my mind knew the value of death. I am not grateful if life is what has been given back to me. I had outlived two wives. My people had settled in the Coop Islands, embraced by Cape Magellan in the south of Elizabeth's Land. I only remember broken pieces of Janosch's agents entering my hut and finding me on a soft cot of mat fiber reeds, a special bed for dying. Elizabeth knew how to die, I say to Janosch. The Ecos, he says. Yes, the Ecos. My wife's name was Rebecca. She would not leave to come here, Janosch says. She told us we were angels and we could have you, take you back to where you were born. Yes. She was your third wife. Yes, I say. Do you want me to tell you everything that happened? I've lived a very long time, Janosch. Janosch appears genuinely distressed. It was not our intention to abandon you, Olmi. You must believe that. The Naderites came to power, and we could not mount the effort for years. When the Geshels took power again, the Jarts pressed us back. And when we finally returned, the geometry stack had become even more tangled, and we could not open the gate. We thought Lamarckia was lost. I understand, I say. My tone is still that of a tired old man, though my voice sounds young. I do not care to press blame. I have had a long and full life. I knew Shirla, and after her, Sikaya, and finally, Rebecca, who was an old woman when I discovered her beauty and loved her. With my death, I will finally be human. I will know where I am. You want to know what she looked like, I say. Nothing of the field or the dome exists anymore, Janosch says. The pillars are bare, the dome is gone. The jungle took over everything. Only what you saw and remember remains. He calls it a jungle, not a silva. And that is what it had become. All green. The last of the old on Shia. I see ghosts around him, incorporeal images of others listening in. I am telling all the Hexamon. I am a celebrity. 25. I approached the frame. Chung would not enter. Frick followed Brian next, for he had been here before. He did not like being here, but he was loyal to Brian. Salop was having an epiphany. His face glowed with enthusiasm, skin creamy with brown shadows in the redness and murk as blocks of storm clouds crossed the sky above the dome. He patted my shoulder, smiled broadly, and passed through the curtain-like membrane into the inner chamber. The membrane sealed smooth behind him like the inverted wall of a thick soap bubble. The voice spoke again, perfect and high. I heard Brian sobbing like a child. I pushed my hand against the membrane, felt it rush around my fingers and wrist and arm like a lip of slick flesh. Within the frame, she stood in the middle of a mass of shiny black hemispheres, studded with black spikes and surmounted by black arches. She wore no clothing and her skin moved, rippling slightly as if she were a badly projected image. Brian stood 2 steps from her, Frick by his side. Brian shook his head, chest racked with sobs. Salop came closer to the female shape, chin in hand, studying her. Her hair hung long and muddy red, motionless and dull, in tufts and spikes to her shoulders. Her face was crudely fashioned, the face of a puppet made by a talented amateur. She paid none of them any attention. Her mouth did not move as she spoke.
"No, not names."
Or,
"No, not names."
"May I speak to it?"
Salop asked. Brian dropped to his knees and lowered his head to the floor, palms flat against the ridged, humped surface that slowly raised and lowered him as if on a swell of ocean. Frick said,
"It isn't what he was hoping for."
Salop approached the shape.
"My name is Mansur Salop. I would like to speak with you," he said, as if introducing himself at a soiree.
The shape inclined its head in his direction, but its eyes, pallid gray-blue within fixed eyelids without expression, could not meet his. It lacked refinements and could not express anything human except in broad strokes. Whatever it had learned, it was woefully incomplete.
"You represent another, don't you?" Salop asked.
"Brian with names, not,"
the voice said, coming from all around. The walls of the frame vibrated like diaphragms, making the sounds, along with other noises. Windy flights of whispering, a steady low frog throat grumble.
"Do you recognize Brian?" Salop asked.
"Talks."
"I talk, and my name is Salop. I brought Caitla here. Where is she?"
Brian asked. Another membrane of tissue withdrew, and the body was visible on a raised hump in the living floor, slack with death, months into its own private decay.
"You understand us," Salop said.
Chung had entered without my noticing and stood 1 step behind me.
"Star, fate, and breath," she said.
The figure turned toward her voice.
"To speak, gave, and use what use. Two now, here."
Chung seemed aghast to be confused with her sister again.
"I am not Caitla," she said.
"You've tried to become Caitla,"
she shouted at Brian.
"She's dead, and you wanted to bring her back."
Brian had stopped weeping and stood before the figure, examining it critically.
"You could try again. More work. More detail."
"It will take a long time to understand us," Salop said.
"Why?"
Brian asked.
"Why so long? It samples us. It must know what we're like."
"We've been mistaken," Salop said. The figure, I realized, had not taken a step. It grew from the floor and could not lift its feet. It was only a little more sophisticated than the discarded husks behind us.
"Caitla and I gave her the chlorophyll," Brian argued. "She took the bottle and used it. She made Caitla plants for her garden, working with the real plants Caitla showed her."
Salop looked back at me. Can you tell him, Serolmi? Bring the sophistication of the thistle down to this little exercise in monstrosity.
For a moment I hadn't a clue what Salop wanted me to say. Then a thought that had been below conscious expression for some months broke through. They've never sampled our genetic structure.
Yes, Salop encouraged, face seeming to glow again like a beacon.
The figure shivered, some rudimentary adjustment in Turgor. Sampling is a way of identifying other scions. Each ecos carries its own markers, its own chemical scheme. We don't fit any schemes. We don't come from other ecoi. They can't analyze our structure from the level of our genetic material, so they have to copy us from the evidence of other senses.
But what about the chlorophyll? Brian demanded.
Salop said, It understands chemistry. It can test and find uses for organic substances. You must have provided the final clues necessary, given the pigments a context it could understand. But it can't break our genetic code. We are too different.
Names, the figure said. Names, no, not.
Chung seemed startled.
Does she actually understand what we're saying?
Or is she... Is it just stringing words together?
She understands, Brian said.
That's a miracle by itself, Chung said. She stepped closer to the figure and to Brian, overcoming some of her repugnance.
What did you talk with before? Salop asked Brian, pointing at the figure.
Before this was created.
When Caitla and I came here, this inner room was filled with tissues, tools. It was a prototype factory. Part of a scion could be grown here, another there. We saw them being carried by giant hairs, cilia, across this chamber, and matched with other parts. And we watched them being dissolved in large pools, turned into jelly or slime, rejected. Caitla realized what this was. She said that we were in a huge cell, all of its parts made large, but because of that, not a cell at all. None of us knew why we had been allowed to come in here. On our last visit, before Caitla became ill, the seed mother, he gestured around the chamber, she showed us the best of her human-shaped scions, still much cruder than this. It could only hum and whistle and make parts of words. Caitla spent a week teaching it, her, before we had to return to Naderville. We knew she wanted to communicate with us directly.
Bring, the voice said. No, bring names.
I brought Caitla back here when she was dying. Caitla told me to leave her here.
Put me where we put my plants, she said.
We knew she could do better.
Brian turned, staring up at the red walls of the frame. He seemed uncertain whether to address the figure directly or speak to the frame, the hemisphere as a whole.
There is so much more you can do.
No making more for this child,
the voice said, acquiring a cello-like timbre. It had also taken on a quality I might have called conviction if it had been human.
New names. No making more. No making more for this child.
Why?
Brian asked, dismayed. The figure swelled again, filling itself with fresh fluids from below. It raised its arms. The color of its skin improved, and the motions in the skin subsided, coordinated, more nearly like the movement of muscles. I watched with queasy fascination the development of its facial features, the refinement of abdomen and breasts, still doll-like, but a better imitation of what Caitla might have looked like, or Hisha.
It's learning from you, Salop said to Chung.
She looked up at the gloomy heights of the frame, searching for eyes among the glints and tiny seafloor glows. Brian seemed stung by this. He took a step back.
It isn't Caitla, he said.
It never will be, Salop said. You've misunderstood what the ecos can do. We've all misplaced our nightmares and our hopes. The figure turned its head, opened its mouth, and the voice issued from the mouth now.
Sounds like smells, names deeper than I know. Two are not one, yet cling. Make third, but within. Third is child, but not like this child. Not I, not of any I, from where?
Then it added the lilt of question. From where?
None of us quite understood.
We're not from this planet,
Brian said quietly, as if this were a devastating admission. I think he was trying to shed the last hope for Caitla, and it was costing him dearly. He had some courage or some curiosity left to speak with the figure at all.
There only is.
The figure lifted one foot, turned slightly on the other, and placed the free foot down awkwardly, bending forward to compensate. It returned to its original posture, but where the foot had lifted away, a small pucker remained. Though it knew the figure of Caitla Hisha would never pass, never enter the realm of a human ecos undetected, it still worked to finish its peculiar scion, the interface for its own selfless and eternal curiosity, the purest and most biological urge to know.
There's more, Brian whispered. Planets and planets and planets. In the sky. Wherever there are stars.
At the mention of stars, the lights within the inner frame scattered in profusion over the braces and walls, dim blue and white, shone out in sudden splendor.
Stars, the figure said.
Brian turned to Frick and Chung.
I know it isn't Caitla. I know I'll never see Caitla again. But I could stay here and tutor her. I could be happy doing that.
Frick rubbed his hands together in front of him, not relishing what he had to say.
Sir Brian, you are needed. We need you.
Brian's brief resurgence of hope withered. He screwed his face up and imitated Frick's gesture of rubbed hands, then pushed his nose with the tips of his fingers.
Bays can take care of those things, he said.
Chung said,
You put far too much on Bays. Someday he'll discover he doesn't need any of us.
Brian jerked his head up at that as if to make a sharp reply, but his eyes turned inevitably to the figure, and all expression melted away.
You have other responsibilities, Salop said soothingly. Everybody else here has other responsibilities. None of you, pardon me, Sir Brian, not even you, is prepared to study and teach here. I am.
What would you teach her?
Brian asked resentfully, unwilling to give up this last possibility of fulfillment of peace.
I would study her, Salop said. And then I would watch her die. I do not think this palace, this field, will be alive much longer, nor any of its kind across Shia. You and Caitla gave her a very powerful name. I think she uses name to mean the chlorophyll you presented to her. She used the name, and that changes everything.
The balloons, I said.
Salop nodded. They carry larval seed mothers, not just scions. If I'm right, in a few weeks, all this will wither.
Old names die, the figure said.
Nightmare, Brian said, words venomous with disappointment. It's all nightmare.
Brian turned to me.
Sir Olmi, you know history. That much change means death and destruction everywhere. The Hexamon must come. I've said it. I've felt it. You must repair Lenk's clavicle. Tell the Hexamon what's happened here.
There was nothing I could say.
For Brian to make a plea on behalf of the humans on Lamarckia seemed ludicrous. Yet he was right.
There was one last thing left to do. Find the clavicle and see if it could be repaired. Brian stepped closer to the figure and touched its face. It did not react, but even as he stroked its cheek, it said,
Are more names? Bring more names.
We left Salop with several weeks' worth of food from the two boats, Brian's and the one that had carried Hisha Chung and her attendants.
I won't die here, no fear of that, Salop told me, walking back with me through the sea of green. I'm a tough old vulture, as you doubtless know. Brian, on the other hand...
Brian had returned to the boat in an impenetrable daze, ignoring us all, and squatted on the bow, staring down the waterway. He had let the string unwind and carried it pinched between thumb and forefinger, lying in loose coils on the polished and painted Xyla deck.
Watch him, Salop told me. He still holds a dangerous amount of political charge, as does Lenk. They must be eased together, or apart.
We stood on overgrown dock, with the new Silva, the jungle, rustling like grass in a wind, though there was hardly a breeze. Salop held me by my shoulders.
"Even if you never get through to the Hexamon, even if they never come, some of us can survive."
26. "Did you ever find the clavicle?" Janosch asks. I am finishing my story outside the hospital. Janosch has been dragged away by greater responsibilities and has returned to find me making progress. We leave the hospital to see some of the sights of the Axis City. I am removing myself from the memories of one long and difficult life. Now we drift and track beside each other in the Vald, the great weightless and terribly green forest in Axis Euclid. My body is so much sweeter and more comfortable, yet I still miss my old life, my impending death, and still ache so much I have incessant thoughts of suicide. If I return through the gate to Lamarckia and try to find Rebecca, but I can't do that. Janosch tells me the gate is sporadic, that years have passed on Lamarckia even since I was retrieved. I do not want the new life, but I will not reject it. In this I have a sense of duty to something much higher than the Hexamon. "I found it," I say. "The Vald's green oppresses me, as it did on Lamarckia, where we ran from continent to continent and finally from island to island, fleeing the power of the name of chlorophyll." "What did you do?" Janosch asks. What he really wants to know is, did I finally act? The story I have told so far is one of observation and hiding, of trying to put pieces together and understand a pattern. But I never did understand completely. The pieces never fit smoothly. I made my decision in ignorance and uncertainty.
27.
Brian did not say a word to anybody in the 18 hours it took us to navigate the length of the canal back to Naderville. The green had progressed dozens of kilometers through the Silva, and along its borders with the thicket, the old growth had wilted, making way for the new. Balloons dotted the horizon and flew overhead, lifting free of the land, blowing with the winds outward. I watched this with a grim numbness and a sense of abject failure. I could not judge Brian as I once had. If anything, I had become more angry with Link. But Link was old and could not bear the weight of all blame. The futility of blame was apparent, but did not lift my gloom. I needed Shirla to bring back my sense of life and reality. Frick took coded messages on the radio within the cabin and brought them forward for Brian to read. He read them and handed them back, shaking his head. Frick became increasingly agitated. Something was happening. Brian sat on the bow, arms wrapped around his drawn-up knees, and stared into the sunset, eyes almost closed, lips drawn into a simian grimace of puzzlement. We motored past the entrance to the lake. I tried to persuade Frick to return me to the lake so that I could rejoin the ships docked there. He looked at Brian, shook his head as if I were a buzzing fly, and finally just ignored me. The guards stood on the rear deck of the small, elegant boat, watching me intently. I thought of diving into the canal and swimming to the shore, or up the offshoot to the lake, but knew they would shoot me if I did. Smoke rose above the tall cliff edge of the Silva as we approached Naderville, but for some minutes the town itself remained hidden. The harbor came into view first, and it was filled with sailing ships. I counted 8, 10, 12, and as the full harbor was revealed, 17. Of all types, full rigs, schooners, big-bodied foremasters, small barks. Flashes erupted from the sides of several of the ships, followed by the heavy blasts of cannon fire and the rushing whistles of falling shells. More flashes from the shore, puffs of smoke and deep thumps announced explosions. The pilot immediately increased the speed of Brian's boat, and Chung's boat hastened to keep pace. As the boats cruised out of the canal entrance, I saw Naderville again, hundreds of homes and buildings arranged along several hills, backed by high dark thicket. Gouts of flame crept from street to street up the hills, and more shells fell, shearing the roofs off buildings and sparking more fires. At least a third of the town had been set ablaze. Shouts and screams carried far and thin across the harbor. Brian stared at the black pillars of smoke with an astonished, hurt expression, then crawled to the middle of the boat and ordered his binoculars. "Lenk lied," Brian said tightly, swinging the binoculars right and left across the city. "He used himself as a blind." Brian lowered the glasses and screamed across the water. "Why didn't Bays know? General Bays, where are you?" We swung toward the northern shore and docked in the early evening at a small private wharf. Chung's boat pulled alongside, and Chung stared at us, grim and frightened. Her assistants, Ullman and Grado, leaped from the boat and tied it, then helped her ashore. 100 meters away, warehouses burned sluggishly, throwing up thick, sour black smoke. The house adjacent to the wharf was beginning to burn as well, as embers landed on its roof. Brian stood with one foot on the gunwale and stared down at me in utter contempt. "You are nothing," he said. "The Hexamon has sent us nothing." He seemed ready to order me shot, but he shook his head and took Frick's hand, climbing up onto the wharf wall. Brian, Chung, Frick, and all the servants and guards ran from the wharf, leaving me alone in the boat. They ran up the harbor road that pointed to Naderville. For a few minutes, I could not move. My legs and arms tingled. I was mesmerized watching the fire sweep down toward the wharf and the boats, the Xyla burning with slow, curling orange flames, thick oily smoke smearing across the dark blue sky. I climbed out of the launch and stood on the harbor road. Wind blew against my back, rushing to feed the fires in Naderville. A woman in a long black dress with a sash of red ran along the shore road alone. This part of the town had already been evacuated, probably as soon as the ships appeared in the harbor. My first impulse was to get back on the boat and cross the harbor, wait on the south shore until the conflagration and fighting had settled. I knew my mission. I was not to interfere, and I was to bring information back to the Hexamon. I could not do that if I was dead. I searched the ships in the harbor for Coragos and Cow, but as I had suspected, neither were visible. Lenk was no doubt keeping them out of the harbor and away from the fighting. I hoped Sherla was with him, and of course Randall. I was sick of the Devaricates and their politics. Lenk's obsessions and calculations all gone wrong, and his hounding of Brian and Caitla, if in fact that was true. I could not fathom Brian's handing power to Bays, and Brian's gift of green to Shea seemed to me obscene, the ultimate monkey play arrogance. If a gate was to open now and pluck me out of the pilot seat on the boat and close forever on Lamarckia, I would not regret leaving. Except for Sherla. She was essential. An anchor against my drift into this madness. She was not particularly beautiful, not particularly intelligent. Nothing about her shone with an ineffable flame. She was merely a woman with a decent set of presumptions and a simple set of goals. She wanted to live a life among friends and peers, live with and love a decent man, raise children to be human beings in a known and familiar place. I loathed any part of me I had seen reflected in Lenk or Brian. Their smallnesses and failures could easily be my own. Even Brian's grief for Caitla seemed cheapened by his arrogance, his presumption that people of such a high standing could not die, that some magic must keep them alive. How did that differ from me? On Thistledown, I would undoubtedly opt for rejuvenation, life extension, and even body replacement. Caitla and Brian had acted on their beliefs, however skewed or inadequate, and so far I had done nothing, used none of my expertise, exercised none of my admittedly few options, managed to always find myself in positions where aloofness was the best choice. Lenk's activism had brought his people here and subjected them to immense suffering. Brian's brash militancy and drive had led to war and murder and had culminated in the madness of the spreading green. What had once dwelled in comparative balance was now overturned and could not be set upright again. My inaction seemed saintly by comparison. Shirla's face kept popping into my thoughts. My mission was over. I had to make a decision, or I would be nothing more than a man filled with vacuum, a non-entity standing always on some thin line. I stepped back from a rush of flame as the wall of the house collapsed. The gust of burning hot air and embers jarred me, and I turned toward the wharf. With the flames roaring behind me, I studied the harbor, judging the strategic position of the ships and boats, the layout of Naderville itself. There was fighting in the town. I could see troops moving through the streets, hear the crack and continuous popping of small arms fire. Lenk had indeed lied to Brian, or expected the worst and had been prepared. He had kept in reserve a ragtag navy assembled of merchant ships and transports. They were now laying siege to Naderville. The 14 vessels had crept into the harbor a few hours before, perhaps signaled by the departure of the two diplomatic ships, Coragos and Cow. The steamships were not visible. Bays must have taken them out of the harbor, perhaps heading back to put more pressure on Jakarta. Lenk's ships had surprised the small defense force and had landed several hundred troops. It had all happened very quickly. There were no masters on Lamarckia. There were only children. Some of the children, however, were more crafty than I had imagined. Lenk had turned out to be smarter, or luckier, than Brian after all. I suspected that Lenk had the superior force, selected from the more capable of the angry citizens of Tasman and Elizabeth's Land. Brian's troops, to judge by the poor fool on the flatboat, might turn out to be little more than opportunistic thugs, poorly trained and cruel, no match for that kind of avenging passion. All of Brian's invincibility had crumpled. The ultimate failings of a frightened, grieving, and angry little man were written all over the hills and streets of Naderville. As the flattened house behind me crackled and exploded, I returned to the deserted boats and examined their supplies and reserves of power. The batteries in Chung's boat were almost drained. Brian's boat, however, had a spare set fully charged. I carried the spare set of batteries to Chung's boat, less identifiable than Brian's elegant launch, removed the flag at the bow and prepared to push off. I cruised quietly through shrouds of dense, choking smoke, not to the south side of the harbor, where there were few, if any, buildings and no visible fighting or shelling going on, but west, along the shore, under the line of fire of the ships in the harbor. Twilight was fading fast. I guided the boat around a smoldering hulk that had once been a wooden merchant vessel. Its crooked trees stuck up out of the water like broken fingers. I wanted to thoroughly understand the strategic situation, find the best vantage point, and then walk into the town and join Link's troops. The gate opener had placed me in a very interesting time indeed, stuck me here like a fly in amber. There would be no returning. Naderville rested on two main hills, with a line of smaller hills along the peninsula between the harbor and the ocean to the north. East of the two main hills, between the town itself and the lake and citadel, a patch of thicket silva had been allowed to remain. The silva would be mined through with tunnels, and if Bays or his subordinates had positioned any last defensive troops or hoped to fight a final action, I surmised they would be hidden in that patch of thicket, or perhaps at the citadel itself, and when opportunity arose, certainly after the artillery barrage, storm up one or both of the hills. I saw a group of soldiers marching down a street on a hill, almost hidden in the shadows of a row of buildings still intact in that quarter of town. They marched about a kilometer and a half from the boat. I could not tell whose troops they were, of course. It was possible that none of Lenk's troops had uniforms, but I couldn't make out the cut of their clothes, or even determine the color. It was necessary to survey the town from farther south to get a better view of the streets and buildings, the centers of potential conflict. I guided the boat south, away from Lenk's ships. Locking the wheel for a moment and searching through the cabin, I found a piece of paper in a drawer and quickly sketched the harbor, the town, and the streets visible. I used the binoculars to gather details, likely administration buildings, a water tower, and what seemed to be a radio mast on the western side of the town. Any one of these could be crucial objectives. By this time I was starting to attract unwanted attention from Lenk's ships less than 2 kilometers away. A gunner had targeted the boat and a shell landed barely a dozen meters away. I did not know what type of guns they had and how accurate they might be, but I could not risk staying on the water any longer. I headed for the docks again. Another shell drenched me with spray. I was less than a dozen meters from shore when a direct hit split the boat in two and flung me backward into the water. Dazed, I floated on my back in the black water of the harbor for several minutes before swimming for the docks. I crawled up a ladder and stood in the darkness between two warehouses, one of them shattered by the shelling, but not on fire. I tried to get my wits together. A piece of Xyla had cut a bloody groove across my forehead. I wiped the blood away with my wet sleeve. The map was gone, but I had most of the details firmly in memory. Naderville was divided by four main east-west streets and seven or eight wide streets running north-south from the harbor to the hills. The buildings that seemed most likely to be administrative, still intact surprisingly, lay on the slopes of the easternmost hill off of a north-south boulevard. I walked toward these buildings. A few civilians still lingered in the town, and the scenes I saw, heading for the eastern hill, could have been several thousand years old. Bodies littered a small courtyard where a shell had exploded. Two large ones, two small. Children. I wondered if Lenk had killed some of his own children. Five older men and several women, heads wrapped in cloth against the smoke, pushed their belongings on a makeshift cart through brick and Xyla rubble. I hid in the half-open doorway of a hollowed-out building to avoid a straggling line of young men and women, not knowing whether they were soldiers. They crossed along an east-west street, shouting encouragement to each other. A few carried electric lanterns. By the glare of one lantern, I recognized the face. Keo, one of Lenk's assistants, following close on the line. I called out his name, and he jerked around, then raised the lantern and spotted me in the doorway. "Olmi! Fate's breath," he said. "You're still alive. We were sure you'd all have been killed when the attack started." He shouted at the retreating backs of the young men and women. "Hold on!" They turned and clustered around us, the whites of their eyes showing like startled deer, breathless, at once frightened and cocksure. "What's happening?" I asked. "Where's Salop?" he asked in return. I did not want to waste time by explaining. "Is the town taken?" Some of the young people shook their heads. Several laughed nervously, milling like dogs. I counted heads and sexes, 8 men, 5 women. "Not yet," Keo said. "There's an action up around Sun Road. Lots of resistance. Baze was back at sea, missed our ships, but swung around to the northern side of the peninsula, landed troops. They're moving back into the town now to replace the soldiers who went to the western peninsula. A diversion. Lenk's auxiliaries, we're all auxiliaries now, grounded a small ship there and burned some houses and buildings. I didn't know about this." Keo's chest jerked. He was hyperventilating in his nervousness. "Randall told us, before he left, and about you." "Is Sherla with Lenk?" Keo's face fell. "The woman? No," he said. "She and Randall were taken by Brian's police 2 days ago, just after you and Salop left with Brian." "We have to go!" shouted one of the young men, an apprentice sailor from one of the schooners, to judge from his clothing. He confronted me. "Whoever you are, we can't stay here clacking teeth. We have to report if there are any troops coming around to the east of town." "That's true," Keo said, clearly uncomfortable with leadership. "He's the Hexamon man," a young woman said, peering at me curiously. Dirt and sweat streaked her lean face, and she seemed stupid with fear and excitement. "He was on Coragos. He's the one they've been talking about." I hardly heard all this. My thoughts raced, trying to think of where they might have taken Sherla. She could still be back at the lake, hidden in the buildings within the old Seed Mother Palace. "I've been out in the harbor, and there's no action to the east. Not yet," I said. "But there could be a contingent of troops back at the lake. Baze might use them to pinch us all. Where are his steamships?"
"North of the peninsula, the last we saw."
Clearly, Baze's most likely plan, the best plan under the circumstances, sketched itself in my head. He had landed the soldiers traveling with the ships in the north, perhaps 2 companies of well-trained men and women, a fair force under the circumstances, but not enough to have much impact. Troops at the old palace could number in the hundreds. If the town had been lightly defended, concentrating the troops in Baze's ships and around Brian's quarters, then that was likely all Baze had to work with, a few hundred troops. The rest would be working Tasman and Elizabeth's land. "How many soldiers does Lenk have?" Keo stared at me, uncertain, sweating in the lantern light. Stars poked through drifting patches of smoke. The shelling had stopped for now.
"You're a soldier from the Hexamon," he said. "Who are you for?"
"Not for Brian," I said. "I need to find Shirla, and you need to secure the town. As you said, I'm a soldier. I have a lot better training than Link, and probably better training than Baze." I could almost see the outline of Keo's thoughts. He had been put in command of these young men, but he had no military education. Few coming to Lamarckia had. They would make a haphazard force at best. I had no idea of the level of their strategic planning. Clearly, Baze had been unprepared for anything like this, but he was likely to put together an effective defense soon. Keo was smart enough to see this.
"Lenk didn't confide in us until the last," he said. "We have maybe 600 volunteers."
"Seven or eight companies," I said.
"Lenk has them ordered differently, I think."
"Who's his general?"
"He designed the operation. Facet helped."
I shook my head in disgust. Keo started to defend Lenk's expertise, but I cut him off. "You have to set up a strong defense in the eastern part of town. At least 200 troops. Baze will almost certainly deploy the forces at the lake. Do you have a radio?"
"Yes," Keo said.
One of his men, little more than a boy actually, lifted a small box.
"Not a lot of range, unfortunately."
The young men and women clustered around us, no longer protesting. I felt a queasy exhilaration. Here, among amateurs, going up against a butcher who was sly at best, I could be useful. Lenk's soldiers occupied the cape and headland in strength, Keo said. To the north and west, positions had not yet been consolidated.
"I need 5 of these good soldiers," I said.
"We should split into 2 groups."
"I have a map, of sorts," Keo said, lifting a cloth satchel and pulling out a small folded piece of paper.
He spread it out in the lantern light. It was an original sketch in pencil and ink, and supplied more detail to what I had seen from the harbor, in particular charting the roads through the Silva from Naderville to the lake. The citadel area was not shown.
"We can use it. You take 1 group and keep watch on the eastern edge of the town. I'll take my 5 and we'll reconnoiter the Silva between Naderville and the lake. For now, tell Lenk's commanders, or Lenk himself, whoever's in charge, that he needs to post at least 100 well-armed men to meet you at the edge of town."
"I don't think we have 100 well-armed men," Keo said.
"Not that we can spare."
What had seemed a major coup in the beginning was looking more and more uncertain. No masters, only children.
"Don't tell Baze that," I said.
I picked the 5 who seemed most fit and enthusiastic, and Keo's group and mine ran in 2 lines along the street until we came to a clearing beyond the last of the houses. Beyond lay the cliff edge of the thicket Silva and the dark holes of 2 tunnel roads.
"Good luck," Keo told me.
I felt incredibly alive and very, very stupid. 28. We made our way down Sanger Road through a thicket tunnel. Sanger was one of 2 parallel roads the map showed going to the lake. The tunnel lights had gone out. We probed ahead with a lantern. I expected to meet a contingent of Baze's troops at any time. The nighttime thicket was still. We walked down the tunnel road for 30 minutes, then emerged under a brilliant star-rich sky, the double oxbow rising in the east. A few lights flickered ahead. We were in a broad clearing, once perhaps a farm area, now barren fields. The road crossed the field toward another thicket, perhaps a kilometer off, and entered another tunnel at that point. I guessed the citadel lay about 2 kilometers beyond. I did not know the palace grounds thoroughly. We could easily get lost. A small young woman named Meg, with a smooth dark face and wide eyes, kept close to me. She carried one of the 3 guns Keo had been willing to spare.
"This is going to be rough, isn't it?" she asked.
"Probably," I said.
"Do you know where we're going?"
"I've been there."
"And you say there are a lot of soldiers?"
"Meg worries for us all," said the oldest male, a tall, stooped fellow of 25 named Brock. "There are a lot of soldiers," I said. "But we're going to avoid them. We don't want to fight. We want to learn things."
"How?"
Meg asked, licking her lips and staring ahead of us at the wall of the next stretch of thicket Silva. "We're going to hide between the tunnel openings. That is, the five of you are. I may take one with me. I'm going on to the old palace. Soldiers will likely come through one or both of the two tunnels. You can see both roads from where you'll hide. If they appear before I get back, we send the fastest runner. That's Yuk, said Meg, pointing to a small, slender woman with fawn-like features. Yuk, I said. You run ahead of the soldiers and report to Ser Keo. He'll give warning with his radio.
What if they use trucks? Yuk asked.
Then we'll change our plans, but the troops will probably be on foot. From what I had seen, Baze had concentrated all their vaunted technology where it would be highly visible. I doubted that they had many more transports or tractors than Calcutta.
What will you do?
I'm going to the old palace, I said again. The citadel.
You keep saying palace. What kind of palace?
Rashnara, the shortest male, asked. It's where Brian lives, I said. No need to explain further. Closing on the opening to the next tunnel, we cut away from the road catter-corner toward the thicket wall between the north and south openings. I stumbled once, and Yuk helped me to my feet. The ground was hard and chalky and had not been plowed for months, perhaps a year. We hugged the thicket, backs against the smooth outer trunks of the arborids that intertwined to make a flat, dark wall.
Why did Ser Keo turn us over to you? Meg asked.
We're not supposed to ask that kind of question, Brock said. It's a good question, I said. Always ask questions.
Why then? Meg asked.
We were about 50 meters from either road. We could see the pavement of each road clearly enough, thin lines of lighter gray against the gray-black soil. A friend of ours told him I had been a member of Hexamon Defense once. Brock sniffed in the dark. Are you that old? No, I said. Not so very old. Not much older than these kids, I reminded myself.
So what does that mean? Meg persisted.
I saw something block out stars and looked up. Balloons floated across the night sky. One dropped its trailing tentacles onto the field, scraping them across the dirt barely 20 meters from where we squatted.
What is that? Asked Olivos, a short, bristle-headed man with a brushy beard.
Yuk stood to run out and investigate, but I grabbed her arm. It's from the interior, I said. A new kind of transporter. I stood and looked down at them. Sir Brock, you have a gun. Will you come with me?
You're asking, not ordering? Brock said, incredulous.
Yes, because what I have to do is partly personal. Brock stood.
You worked in Wade Defense, he asked.
A long time ago.
I'll come, he said.
If we're not back in 2 hours, you can assume we've been captured, I told the rest. Meg, you're in charge.
Thank you, I think, Meg said. Does anybody have a watch?
Nobody did. Count then, I said. Brock and I walked north to the Godwin Road and stood in the middle of the stone slab and gravel pavement, staring into the tunnel's impenetrable darkness. We had no lantern. The tunnel was quiet except for the sound of dripping water. Let's go, I said.
What are we going to do? He asked.
See what the troops are up to and rescue a friend, I said. If they're still there at all.
You think they might have come by water?
Not if they're smart. The harbor belongs to Link for the time being. It seemed likely that Baze would try to retake the harbor. I hoped we could be back before that happened. We're not going to talk while we're in the tunnel, okay? Brock nodded. Brush your hand against the left side. I'll stay to the right. We walked for 50 meters in complete darkness. The air was getting thick and smelled stale. Brock coughed and apologized in a whisper. Whiffs of an ammonia-like smell, tangy and very unpleasant, met us farther down the tunnel. Sounds from above filtered down to us, rustling, shifting. With some relief, we came to the end of the tunnel and stood in a field. A few lights gleamed across the field, electric lanterns bobbing to and fro, and we heard subdued voices. From the west, more explosions and the distant pop of cannon. I guessed we were at the northern end of the lake, west of the citadel. I could barely make out the black shapes of buildings. A light came on in a distant window. A voice called out, and the light was quickly extinguished.
Brian's soldiers, Brock whispered, standing close beside me.
They could be evacuated civilians, I said. We don't know yet. I doubted anyone would see us if we cut across to the right, where the Silva massed again as a solid wall. With a few words and gestures, I made our route clear and we set out across a flat, empty field that had never been plowed.
"Give me your gun," I said.
"Why, sir?"
"Do you want to have to kill someone?"
He handed me the gun. It was a heavy, short-barreled rifle of simple design. We followed the line of the thicket, slowly, trying to keep on our feet over the uneven ground. A shape sprawled across the dirt a few meters in front of us, a black blur in the starlit darkness. I thought for a moment it was a human body, but it gave off a thick ammonia smell. I bent over it briefly and saw a tangle of limbs, a long cylindrical body, sharp digging barbs around its tail. My neck hairs tingled. It was a dead scion. Nothing had come to pick it up and take it away. This was the smell of death on Lamarckia. The closeness in the tunnel had also been death.
"Fate and breath," Brock said. "What is it?"
"A scion," I said. "It's dead."
"Why don't the cleaners come and get it?"
"Things are changing," I said. We edged around it. I had little doubt it was one of the thicket's mobile scions, so seldom seen outside the tangle of arborets. The thicket Silva, after tens or hundreds of millions of years, was being told to die. In buildings to our left, we heard footsteps and voices, orders given. Soldiers were getting organized. I heard snatches of conversation.
"We'll get them in a vice at Jalapat. They're fools. Blood-thick fools. Who's got the squadron radio?"
So these were the troops, comprised of most of the old palace's guards and security. I could not judge how many there were. At least 100.
"Form up,"
a loud, authoritative female voice said.
"West in 10 minutes.
I stopped and Brock bumped into me.
"Hear that?"
I whispered very softly in his ear. He nodded.
"That's what we need to know.
Run back and tell the others to report this to Serkio."
"You're not coming with me?"
he asked. He was clearly unhappy at the thought of going back alone. Unhappy also, I surmised, at the thought of going back down the strange-smelling tunnel.
"I thought you needed me."
"I needed you for this. It's time," I said. "You have your duty. I'm going to find my friends." I handed him the rifle. "Take this with you. I hope I won't need it." Brock hesitated for a moment, backed away with arms folded, then dropped them by his sides, turned, and walked into the darkness. He skirted the dead scion, and I could no longer make him out in the darkness. Somehow I had contrived to be alone again. I had always preferred working alone, even in Way Defense. I wondered if one's life history was the result of world lines collapsing in response to simple force of character. The dilemma had not been solved in 1,000 years of human philosophy. I walked quietly and quickly between two buildings. A single moon rose and cast some extra light. This was not good. I tried to stay in deeper shadow wherever possible. I had to be within 100 meters of the old palace complex. I entered a courtyard through a narrow, open corridor. A fountain in the center of the courtyard threw a steady ribbon of water into the air, splashing and chuckling to itself. Staying close to the wall, my feet scuffing lightly on a gravel-covered walkway, I passed a line of doors and darkened windows through another corridor. A few lights danced in an alley between the courtyard and a wall. I flattened myself against the wall and felt large, smooth, round stones. The old palace. The lights, two men gripping lanterns, moved past the entrance to the alley. If whoever was in charge felt the situation was desperate, and Brian was no longer here, this area might be almost deserted. In a couple of hours, dawn glow would begin lighting the sky. I followed the curve of the ancient stone wall for 50 or 60 meters before reaching a gate. Three men stood by the gate, talking softly in the darkness. I pitched my voice to just the right volume and tone of concern.
"Excuse me, don't be alarmed. Sir Frick..."
All three guns instantly pointed at me, and I heard three simultaneous snick-clacks as rounds were chambered.
"I'm one of Brian's guests. I'm not armed. Sir Frick left me in a boat at Naderville." "Who are you?"
"My name is Olmi," I said.
"Frick isn't here,"
the tallest guard said, a bulky shadow with a gravelly voice.
"Where am I supposed to go?"
"We don't have any instructions about you."
"Sir Brian told me to come back here on the water, but the boat was destroyed. I had to walk. It was frightening."
"You were with Brian?" the gravel-voiced guard asked. "I've heard about you," another guard said, and they conferred in whispers for a moment. "You went with Frick and Sir Brian, didn't you? Where did you go?"
"Up the canal," I said.
"Come here."
I stepped up, and the tall guard allowed a thin beam of light to play across my face from a slit in his lantern.
"I think he's the one," the second guard said. "Go inside and find out if anybody wants him."